Harriet Mullen has an extraordinary talent in committing a certain type of rigor to the pleasure of living with language as a way to expand upon the infinite possibilities of experience and whose tongue is speaking. She says of her work in Urban Tumbleweed, Notes from a Tanka Diary, "This diary began with a desire to strengthen a sensible habit by linking it to a pleasurable activity. I wanted to incorporate into my life a daily practice of walking and writing poetry. As committed as I am to writing, I needed a break in my routine, so I determined to alter my sedentary, unconsciously cramped posture as a writer habitually working indoors despite living here in sunny California. With a pen and notebook tucked into my pocket, I could escape from the writer's self-imposed confinement, if only to walk from home to the local post office. With the Tanka Diary to focus my attention, a pedestrian stroll might result in a poem." What I find most impressive about her work is that it's not enough for her to simply liberate herself from the writing studio. She takes it one step further by liberating the form when it is most necessary. She says about this, "While embracing the notational spirit of the Tanka tradition, I depart from established convention in both languages, choosing instead a flexible three-line form with a variable number of syllables per line. I try to adhere to the 31-syllable limit, although I'm aware that the number of syllables in a given word can vary depending on the speaker and the circumstances. California, for example, sometimes has 4 syllables, at other times 5. The brevity and clarity of Tanka make it suitable for capturing concise form, the ephemera of everyday life. With refined awareness of seasonal changes and a classical repertoire of fleeting impressions, seasonal poetry contemplates, among other things, the human being's place in the natural world. Idea I wanted to explore in. What is natural about being a human city dweller taking a nature walk while listening to a podcast with earbud headphones? What of a poet who does not know the proper names of native and non-native fauna and flora, who sees a yellow flower by the creek, Mimulus? Harriet Mullen, several poetry collections, including Recyclopedia, Winner, and Sleeping with the Dictionary, a finalist for a National Book Critics Circle Award and the Los Angeles Times Book Prize. Her poems have been translated to Spanish, Portuguese, French, Italian, Polish, German, Swedish, Danish, Turkish, Bulgarian, and I can't even say this, Gherkis, thank you. A collection for essays and interviews, The Cracks Between, was published in 2012 by University of Alabama Press. Her poetry collection, Urban Tumbleweed, Notes from a Tanka Diary, was a top pick by the Los Angeles Times. She teaches American poetry, African American literature, and creative writing at UCLA. Please welcome Harriet Mullen.
Thanks, everyone, for being here. And I'm glad to be here. I felt almost that I should be reading from Urban Tumbleweed, which was my last book, most recent book, but I'm just simplifying my life and reading from Sleeping with the Dictionary tonight, and forgive me if you've heard these too many times, but I'm doing it again. So, I'm reading these poems partly because, as I was just discussing with Adam, this book continues to have a life, and which is so amazing to me. It's the gift that I you know, don't deserve. But and some of these poems are actually being translated again, you know. Some were translated into Brazilian Portuguese and are now being translated into the Portuguese of Portugal. And then a poem that was translated by one Mexican poet is being translated by another Mexican poet. So I have now 2 versions of denigration in Mexican Spanish that I can now compare. So it's kind of amazing to me that this book keeps going. So this is X-ray vision. You don't need X-ray vision to see through me. No superpowers required to penetrate my defense. Without Liz's rant, you can tell motives are transparent. A sturdy ishin could give you the strong and flimsy. Before the flat lady sang the first note of the book, you knew that my story was thin. And this next one is Coles to Newcastle, Panama hats from Ecuador. And this poem was written actually when I was pretty new to Los Angeles and still experiencing a certain culture shock. I grew up in Texas and I was born in Alabama. Watching television in Los Angeles, this scene performed in real time, in real life, a pretty picture walking and sitting still. It's still life with fried spam, light pound cake, non-dairy cream. It's death by chocolate. It's corporate warfare as we know it. I'm stuck on the fourth step. There's no statue or stature of limitations. I'll be emotionally disturbed for as long as it takes. You can give a man a rock, or you can teach him to rock. Access your higher power. Facts back the map of your spiritual path. Take 20 drops, tincture of worrywort. Who's paying for this if you're not covered? You're too simple to be so difficult. Malicious postmodernism. Petroleum jelly donut dunked in elbow grease. You look better going than coming. You look like death eating microwave popcorn. Now that I live alone, I'm much less introspective. Now you sound more like yourself. And I'm going to read this poem called Present Tense. Now that my ears are connected to a random answer machine, the wrong brain keeps talking through my hat. Now that I've been licked all over by the English tongue, my common law spout is suing for divorce. Now that the Vatican has confessed and the White House has issued an apology, I can forgive everything and forget nothing. Now the overdrawn credits roll as the bankrupt star drives a patchwork cab to the finish line where a broke robot waves a mended tablecloth, which is the stale flag of a checkmate career. Now that the history of civilization has been encrypted on a medium grain of rice, it's taken the starch out of the stuffed shorts. Now, as the voice of America crackles and fades, the market reports that today the euro hit a new low. Now, as the reel unravels, our story unwinds with the curious dynamic of an action flick without a white protagonist. And this next poem is a collaboration between me and NPR. So some of NPR language got into this poem, The Anthropic Principle. You know, someone was explaining what that is. The Pope of Cosmology addresses a convention. When he talks, the whole atmosphere changes. He speaks through a computer. When he asks, can you hear me? The whole audience says yes. It's a science locked up in a philosophical debate. There are a few different theories. There could be many different realities. You might say ours exists because we do. You could take a few pounds of matter, heat it to an ungodly temperature, or the universe was a freak accident. There may be a limit to our arrogance, but one day the laws of physics will read like a detailed instruction manual. A plane that took off from its hub in my hometown just crashed in the president's hometown. The news anchor says the pilot is among the dead. I was hoping for news of the president's foreign affair with a diplomat's wife. I felt a mystical connection to the number of confirmed dead whose names were not released. Like the time I was three handshakes from the president. Like when I thought I heard that humanitarians dropped a smart blonde on the Chinese embassy. Like when the cable was severed and chairs fell from the sky because the pilot flew with rusty maps. What sane pilot would land in that severe rain with hard hail and gale force wind? With no signal of distress, with no foghorns to warn the civilians, the pilot lost our moral compass in the bloody quagmire of collateral damage. One theory says it's just a freak accident locked up in a philosophical debate. It's like playing poker, and all the cards are wild. Like the arcane analysis of a black box, full of insinuations of error. So this poem, Suzuki Method, which kind of strays from the initial idea. Well, there was the initial idea that you teach music, children learn music the way they learn their mother tongue. That was a, kind of like the essential foundation of Suzuki Method. And then someone visiting from Japan came to Los Angeles, and I was showing this person around L.A., and we went to the Watts Tower. So from that came this poem. El Niño brought a typhoon of tom-toms from Tokyo, where a thrilling instrument makes an okay toy. Tiny violins are shrill. Their shrieks are musical mice. The color of a mechanical clock is lost in translation. Whatever you're telling me sounds like the straight teeth of rodents. My dreams throw the book at the varmint. We both shudder as the dictionary thuds. You've got to admit our Esperanto's hopeless. Your virgin is unfaithful. My savory hero boards the ship of Marco Polo, loaded with soy from Ohio. So that was kind of an East meets West poem. I'm going to read Resistance is Fertile. Oh, some of you may have watched Star Trek once in a while, in its many iterations. This system needs your moral fiber like a bowl of X brand flakes. If your kind cannot be assimilated to make spare parts for Borg wars, your resistance challenges the ant farm to adapt. You might think the system's tone deaf, but our software's immune. You are the virus that keeps it in tune. We are the tolerant host, which makes you the guest worker colony of E. coli, the chitlins inside the chitlins, catching hits off our perfect pitch. Your contra fits a false note passed through the phony caca. We call you irresponsible, say you're indigestible, but it's undeniably true, it's tough to swallow you. Your data resisted analysis, but if you are not consumed, your flawed construction only proves that we are perfection cubed. Did you need to read the label on Olean to know the SOS goes out when the chip's going down? To Cuisinart our metaphors once again, let's just say that Dracula's liquid protein diet could use some roughage to help with his next smooth move. A bloodsucker's got to worry about irregularity, so pollsters press the pulse, take specimens of the blood count. Pundits poo-poo as law and order candidate Bruce Wayne leaves his potty to go on a turd pooty ticket. Libertarian runs on a bowel movement platform. The result will be a better grade of guano piling up in the bat cave. Our constipation requires frequent amendments to feed the tree of liberty. Can you dig it? Can you dig it, man? You're digging it with a shovel. We're all pooped out. We're just waiting to send in. And I will read Wino Rhino. I'm just about to make a trip to Sacramento, and I went on a TripAdvisor to see where I could stay in a hotel, and just about every single one of the comments said, so many homeless people. They were lying on the sidewalk. They were sleeping at the bottom of the stairwell at the hotel. I mean, only one of them asked us for money, but still, you just don't feel safe. So anyway, this is Wino Rhino. For no specific reason, I have become one of the city's unicorns. No rare species, but one in range of danger. No mythical animal, but a common creature of urban legend. No potent stallion woven into poetry and song. Just the tough, horny beast you may observe roaming at large in our habitat. I'm known to adventurers whose drive-by safari is the circumscribed wilderness. Denatured photographers like to shoot me, tipping the bottle, capture me, snorting dust, mount on the wall my horn of empties that spilled the grape's blood. My flesh crawls with itchy insects. My heart quivers as arrows on street maps target me for urban removal. You can see that my hair's stiffened and my skin's thick, but the bravest camera can't document what my armor hides, how I know you so well, why I know my own strength, why when I charge you with my rags, I won't overturn your sporty Jeep. Going to go to Denigration. That's the poem that now exists in two Spanish versions. Because they got to deal with race too, you know? It's everywhere. Did we surprise our teachers who had niggling doubts about the picayune brains of small black children who reminded them of clean pickaninnies on a box of laundry soap? How muddy is the Mississippi compared to the third longest river of the darkest continent? In the land of the Igbo, the Hausa, and the Yoruba, what is the price per barrel of nigrescence? Those slaves who were wealth, survived on niggardly provisions, should inheritors of wealth fault the poor enigma for lacking a dictionary? Does the mayor demand a recount of every bullet? Or does City Hall simply neglect the black alderman's district? If I disagree with your beliefs, do you chalk it up to my negligible powers of discrimination, supposing I'm just trifling and not worth considering? Does my niggling concern with trivial matters negate my ability to negotiate in good faith? Though Maroons, who were unruly Africans, not loose horses or lazy sailors, were called renegades in Spanish, will I turn any blacker if I renege on this deal? So let's see, I think two more to go. I'm gonna read We Are Not Responsible. And that one appeared in a book called, what is it called? It's a poetry and protest. From Emmett Till to Trayvon Martin. So, yes, poetry can be political. We are not responsible. We are not responsible for your lost or stolen relatives. We cannot guarantee your safety if you disobey our instructions. We do not endorse the causes or claims of people begging for handouts. We reserve the right to refuse service to anyone. Your ticket does not guarantee that we will honor your reservations. In order to facilitate our procedures, please limit your carrying on. Before taking off, please extinguish all smoldering resentments. If you cannot understand English, you will be moved out of the way. In the event of a loss, you better look out for yourself. Your insurance was canceled because we can no longer handle your frightful claims. Our handlers lost your luggage and we are unable to find the key to your legal case. You were detained for interrogation because you fit the profile. You are not presumed to be innocent if the police have reason to suspect you are carrying a concealed wallet. It's not our fault you were born wearing a gang color. It is not our obligation to inform you of your rights. Step aside, please, while our officer inspects your bad attitude. You have no rights that we are bound to respect. Please remain calm, or we can't be held responsible. Well, what happens to you? And I'm going to end with the title poem, Sleeping with the Dictionary. I beg to dicker with my silver-tongued companion, whose lips are ready to read my shining gloss. A versatile partner, conversant and well-versed in the verbal art, the dictionary is not averse to the solitary habits of the curiously wide-awake reader. In the dark night's insomnia, the book is a stimulating sedative, awakening my tired imagination to the hypnagogic trance of language. Retiring to the canopy of the bedroom, turning on the bedside light, taking the big dictionary to bed, clutching the unabridged bulk, heavy with the weight of all the meanings between these covers, smoothing the thin sheets thick with accented syllables, all are exercises in women of dreamers who toss words on their tongues while turning illuminated pages. To go through all these motions and groping in the dark for an alluring word is the poet's nocturnal mission. Aroused by myriad possibilities, we try out the most perverse positions in the practice of our act, the work. Any exit from the logic of language might be an entry in a symptomatic dictionary. The alphabetical order of this ample block of knowledge might render a dense lexicon of lucid hallucinations. Beside the bed, a pad lies open to record the meandering of migratory words. In the rapid eye movement of the poet's night vision, this dictum can be decoded like the secret acrostic of a lover's name. Thank you.
Some of you may already know, Adam Fitzgerald is the reason we are all here. 4 years ago, he and two other poets created this writing conference, homeschool experience, happening, whatever you want to call it, in the image of the collage environment of his friend and mentor, John Ashbery's home. The thing I find to be the most interesting is how Adam seems devoted to marrying the lineage of poetry to the contemporary in his work with the poetry community, as well as in his own writing, both for himself and in writing about others, with intricate attention to how the schisms of language affect and deflect in this particular political moment. You might kill me for putting this story in, but I couldn't resist. I found this childhood antidote from an interview he did with the Creative Independent that I believe speaks to this embodied devotion to giving space for others to find their own on the page. This is Adam. I remember writing poems in elementary school. I remember this one I wrote, which I just found. It's very weird, and I must have written it when I was like 8 or 9. And I can remember showing it to the teacher, and I guess she got very concerned and frazzled. Her face wrinkled into, is something going on at home? What's wrong? It was called something like Doors of Life, about how life is this infinite hallway of passing from room to room, but some people get trapped in certain rooms and don't get to pass through. I had to consult with the principal, a school psychologist, and our rather goofy counselor. My response was, I just wanted to write a poem. Adam Fitzgerald is the author of 2 books, The Late Parade and George Washington. His poems, essays, and interviews have appeared in a public space, The American Reader, Boston Review, The Brooklyn Rail, Conjunctions, Fence, and elsewhere. He teaches at Rutgers University and lives in the East Village. Please welcome Adam Fitzgerald.
Yeah, maybe I should be reading that poem tonight. How's everybody doing? Good. I still think Sleeping with the Dictionary is like one of the greatest books of all time, so I'm ready for the next reading of it. Kat mentioned that homeschool was something that got started in 2014. It actually got started on the weekend of August 9th, 2014. And by coincidence, that was a strange way of putting it. It was the weekend of Michael Brown's murder in Ferguson. And while I was coming up on the train the day before, I was holding a advanced galley copy of Claudia Rankine's Citizen in my hand. And I think the kind of confluence of those events on the week of that weekend is something that I've still been trying to kind of work through and process as a white poet and teacher. One of my students asked me that weekend why most of the poets I referred to were white men during the week, and I didn't have an answer. So what I'm going to read from tonight is part of a trilogy of works that I'm working on. It's three books, or three different manuscripts. The first is a series of documentary excavation about the origins of white supremacy. I really wanted to find the very first instances of white identity. What were their contexts? What were their situations? What were the first laws? Have they ever been published? Do people know about them? Do people talk about them? When and what was happening in the world where this aspect started coming into being? And just as I thought I was kind of finishing up this kind of year-long look through too many history books that weren't being very helpful, mostly written by white scholars, I came across the work of Frank Wilderson and started rethinking everything that I was trying to do, not in relation to white identity, but actually rather in terms of anti-blackness. And so it's great to be here with Frank Wilderson, who's been so important to the work that I've been trying to do. The second book, and I don't know why I'm mentioning this, but I think it just helps me understand what I've been about. The second work that I'm trying to do is a series of essays on kind of looking at particularly white poets and how they kind of conceive and imagine race, especially not just easy, soft targets for poets who we already think of as kind of racist or have terrible politics, but poets that we supposedly love or admire or don't necessarily think of as racialized. And there's really everyone you can think of to consider in that way. And then finally, the part I'm just going to read excerpts from tonight is kind of a long poem. And so between kind of roughly a kind of a historical eventual investigation, a kind of literary, critical, poetic investigation, and then this kind of more documentary long poem, this kind of forms the three kind of prongs I'm thinking about, but trying how to respond to some of the subject material I've been researching. So I'm just going to read excerpts from this, and just one thing I just want to note is there is a passage that I may read from during the reading, and it begins with the phrase, the Chinese are not white. And it's a series of documents that you can find in this book called White by Law. And one of the amazing things that the book does is it tracks and traces who the United States of America in state and federal courts has legally decided has counted as a white person or has not counted as a white person. So that's that. And without further ado. This is a documentary at the end of my life, the big new one. To say what I've unlearned is to say what I've learned. To speak out straight, not possible. To name just the violence is not possible, as in not possible as yet. It is time to speak again, not in tongues or new words, the proud riot of a meaning, a rash of it overtaking myself, the venomous self in completion, the ominous omen in itself. As all war films are the glorification of war, and all epics lies about my father, birth pang and war cry, the riot and patriotic, it is not that, as in only that, the place of no place, the land of someone's unpeopled and peopled, and the vast closeting of history in your mild community of psychic like, the like-minded, the bleeding constructs a company grammar you work in called as if, called like. We live in at least two worlds, and one of them is not a spectrum's expectation. One of them's historical time, the third rail that electrifies the calm security of quietly dying. The other is everything else. Variations on not so much a theme of injustice as the constant practice of peripheralization, an extermination to study that is also quite literally the extermination of study. What would it mean to reckon without the adjustments, to name the inflammatory devices by which a very coherent violence offers its jagged edge? And what would it say, and where would you begin, and what would even matter? Failure is emphatic speech. When I was a teenager, I didn't want to be our Lord and Savior. I wanted people to know I was already Him of Him. The messianic light going off in my closet of my skull like a soft bomb of day's daylight by fog-bound harbor, erect as virtue's headless statue. One night I awoke from a terrible dream of myself as the man from Galilee, found one of my followers had given me a blowjob while I was sleeping. I've always wanted to quit smoking. I still want to. I wanted to quit my body and quit my flesh and live in another world that was not also this one. The pivotal moment in any white teenager's life when they realize their uncle is the king who killed his father is actually his father. And the panic attacks of a very intimate violence constricts the leisure of pleasure in family romance. This never happened. To not be cynical in our dissolutions is most often a measure of promise. I promise a promise of contributing to society, a kind of compulsory heterosexuality. The scab pulls back. The mattress is uprooted. The violence of the mind awaits its body. My family is sick. My body is sick. My mind is sick. The language of pathology is of no use. No use to me now. I give it away and give also up the ghost of bios as myth following Sylvia Winter. Let the human die his death. No one mourns. Many are still resisting. Too few are chosen. A professor tweets something to the effect a friend tells me about all I want for Christmas is white genocide. He is stripped, fired, so what? The abolition of freedom, in Fred Moten's phrase, will not come from the race of masters, settlers, humans. Frank Wilderson's apt thesaurus. So what is there? There isn't poetry, the same poetry that is. Weapons are left out on the table, and the meaning of violence, the question of ethical violence, rises like a bubble in the agile woven fields of my thoughts, like the skies as yet unwritten writing. Very few of us have answers, and too many of us beg without even almost admitting it. I think I know what was meant by the argument that all moral philosophy leads back to religion, finally. What if religion dies, the religion of fathers, a moral philosophy too? The precepts of fathers. There are two truths I accept about the world. One is patriarchy, the other anti-blackness. All I was ever trained to do was write my nonsense poetry about either I have nothing, I say out nothing, I believe no white word. The teachers warn of virtue signaling without ever considering the virtue of signaling anything at all. There is no ethical stance of a white person. There is no ethical relation between white people. The state cannot be reformed. But the ontic optics go on, critique takes a pass, and the bedrock reality is flammable and knows that the meaning of fire is fire. A person drifts off, personality melts like bars of soap whose repeated use cleans none, nothing, and yet the nothing remains. The language of pointing, assuming a standstill, an agreement about the ground. As Samaz points out to me, the routine vileness of metaphor, the project of metaphor. She points to how show don't tell was a military strategy, a literal liberal strategy of post-war funding of the Iowa model of the writing workshop. I have always hated the poem as sermon. Quote, Orpheus's sermon did not condemn, wrote Emily Dickinson. And down each loop only further imbricated dread. And as I believe only two or one, the variation, genocidal outsourcing. There is no elegance, there is no message, the flesh burns away. The apostles were covered in horned flames, tongues of fire. I had been a stormtrooper in a galaxy far away from the earliest age, clad in standard issue gear. I believed without needing to believe in the peacekeeping mission arranged for the universe, dreamt of since an early age to stand in starkest white and think the live fire drills meant necessary force. They trained us to treat our armor like it was part of us, not a second body, but our first. Plastoid composite above a fitting nylon body glove. The leather boots were nice. The strange blaster bolts were nice. Everything strangely felt right. Reinforced alloy, plating thighs, breathing apparatus fit for mortal combat. People die all the time, but the human form comes home incomplete without the wearer's armor brandishing tip to toe, head to feet. We march sleekly through smooth Miami waters, learn one's designation pods being a cohesive unit, the doctrine of stars, strength in order, one law for all planets. The built-in visor display, like its own silent dumb show cosplay. Filtration happens unconsciously, broadband communication downloads demands in my antennae brain. Simple sense of how to target, diagnostic process, assist, and when necessary, shriek and run away. Darkness, glare, and smoke are facts of life. So the civilian's oath hinges on alert fog and sensuous motion-paneled eyesight. Non-essential chatter is strictly off-limits. Everything's recorded and nothing is reviewed. Yes, outside worlds are dangerous. Tundras of ice, wasteland forests, streams with plodding lava channels and soft networks capped. Asteroid clusters bearded with foam amid debris, the vast redundancies of sands, more than a single man could ever understand what we withstand. So many spaces, so many alien languages, the endless furs and binary religions, beyond youth snuffed out like a Death Star, whose poster hung above my head in bed from the earliest, remotest time. For a long time, I used to go to bed early. Don't you remember when public rage, Eve's concentrated phrase, all the home and comfort, and here's my dean, extra, extra, when the thermos off with large swallowing blank, amid shriveled, shredded, rubbed fog, though one recognizes these like us as situated in the void of the pasty scale. Look at this beauty, too. This is the part of the story. Acknowledge the air, what came before and after is not so very different. Like how a base model figurine is modified on pioneer, the inquisitive assimilative of Federation, etc. In mass, guess who? Space station's heart, fragments, blue needle. All number is F, has nothing. I'm looking at my wife while looking out an Amtrak window. Astral pretty scenery, the ghostly upstate mountain, along the Hudson. It always struck haunted territory before I ever knew how. 10 years ago, alive up there, I was struck by the fabled town's B-movie charm. The lonely, wide way lanes at night, two lanes, four lanes. At night, everything hovers between isolation and desolation. Susan Howe hints at these long drives as something of a serial killer's paradise. By day, nature resumes the startled pun. Do you feel barrenness immense and lonely, barrenly lovely? The land affect, the landscape is queer. You erect colored cubes transparent in the fields. The strawberry auburns rough in their leaf meal glitter, their large fisted dapple foliage whistling inside the autumnal like a nerve's vein. My mother's death had gone according to plan, her plan. Opioid cocktails slathering her open, withered body drip by drip as much as possible. The importance of lucidity is overrated and underrated. Fearing death, her fear of cremation. When I imagine myself like a minor character of Dante's Hell, swimming the fume rivers, my lungs witnessing the billowing clouds out my lungs before I get to a second death's death. And at the end, there she was, in the slumped over, mute, over-medicated person half-curled up herself, embedded in an intricate mesh of cords and medical blankets, body leaves to prevent her legs from clotting. Vain, glamorous, and stubborn, oxygen. All the liquid screens like professional mourners stand for me to look down at her. Heart monitors, call buttons, remote control entangled in her tent. In the end, sometimes she consciousness, her breathing, unable to witness, was totally hers still. Mom, that's my hand. I know it looks, but it's my phone. Pulls her phone number into my palm seriously. My white hand. There is a position, the comfort in inward think, the comfort in structural critique, in inventory. Suicide or mass suicide, fantastical, silent, talking out, comfortable, urgent contribution, escape the white body, mouth, and fame position. There is no ethical, but conscious poem. Reflexivity is all. What is he supposed about another friend's work? I link from Vulag, quote, the chain. In the closest thing to a song of myself, the nation building project is a dream. The heating system. They all go away. They put away, they fade away, and stay away. Girls, oh lavender boys. Nature's way goes away. Take away in salt shakers, condos, the dead and dying. While some take their way along the way, what they cannot say. Fades away, knowing this, but going out of their way, underway, sway of starry phase, look at them as they go away, shall go away, be taken away and put away, isn't clear, the way, try punching your way out of this, they go, have gone away, proper, pricked, appointed, paid, vaunted over, plowed under, just up a ways, over yonder. The wind bends its calcite back the wrong way, half erased, clustered. They go away and stay away. A world of hate, lovely, bright error, wangled, wended, rubbed out, scratched out. In a tree hangs the lobster, not symbol, oh gentle strangers, goodbye. My lo-fi genders say hello, dream rubbers, murders and barbed wire picnics, mown down, torn down, being of the enemy, body of my dearly beloved, they have been, are put down and put away for good. You were born on 9/11 in a freshman dorm, less than a mile away from the hijackers. A star danced when I was born. No, something clapped and snapped inside me. I was born on September 11th in my 18th year, living in Newton, Massachusetts, near a workaday Holiday Inn. The Americans, storytellers, told themselves a big story, and I went along for the ride. Quote, where is the acknowledgement that this is not a cowardly attack on civilization or liberty or humanity or the free world, but an attack on the world's self-proclaimed superpower undertaken as a consequence of specific American alliances and actions? End quote. Confidence building and grief management. Confidence building as grief management. Tall buildings shake, voices escape, singing sad, sad songs. Time of white terror pours concrete, fresh panic attacks ooze, Thanksgiving, New Jersey transit commutes, wars of my body. The clouds over Rutgers campus tonight hold their departmental meeting, are tinged in blood and black lilac. The land is here unnamed, emailed anonymously over warring skies. Arguments are heard and electrically go out, bordered by trusty inns, dumpling cars swimming in adjunct ease, ventricles of statuary lamp, monuments menstrual gray, documenting shadow, undocumenting shadow, shadow, shadow. Buzz voices spread cheese. Defeated demons grant blush impasto. Walled invisibility patrols hundreds of years of Christian time, the fair clearing of the student lawn. Terry Gilliam's 12 Monkeys stars white people. Michael Anderson's 1984 stars white people. Stanley Kubrick's 2001 A Space Odyssey stars white people. Steven Spielberg's AI stars white people. Ridley Scott's Alien stars white people. James Cameron's Avatar stars white people. Robert Zemeckis' Back to the Future Part 2 stars white people. Ridley Scott's Blade Runner stars white people. Stanley Kubrick's A Clockwork Orange stars white people. Doug Liman's Edge of Tomorrow stars white people. Gavin Hood's Ender's Game stars white people. John Carpenter's Escape from L.A. stars white people. John Carpenter's Escape from New York stars white people. Paul Anderson's Event Horizon stars white people. David Cronenberg's Existence stars white people. Luc Besson's The Fifth Element stars white people. Andrew Niccol's Gattaca stars white people. Chuck Jones's Her stars a lot of white people in tall pants. Gary Ross's The Hunger Games stars white people. Christopher Nolan's Interstellar stars white people. Chris Marker's La Jetée stars white people. Ryan Johnson's Looper stars white people. Stephen Hopkins's Lost in Space stars white people. The Wyakovsky's The Matrix stars white people. Fritz Lang's Metropolis stars white people. Steven Spielberg's Minority Report stars white people. Franklin Schaffner's Planet of the Apes. John Hillcoat's The Road. Paul Verhoeven's RoboCop. Woody Allen's Sleeper. J.J. Abrams' Star Trek. Paul Verhoeven's Starship Troopers, Catherine Bigelow's Strange Days, Jim Cameron's The Terminator, Joseph Raznak's The 13th Floor, George Lucas's THX-1138, Per Verhoeven's Total Recall, Len Wiseman's Total Recall. In 1955, Baldwin wrote, "This world is white no longer, and it will never be white again." Samuel Delaney, 1977, quote, "Sometime, somewhere, somebody is going to write a review of Star Wars that begins, quote, in Lucas's future, the black races and the yellow races have apparently died out, and a sort of Midwestern American, with a few Southwesterners who seem to specialize in being warship pilots, have taken over the universe. By and large, women have also been bred out of the human race, and save for the odd gutsy princess or the isolated and cowed aunt, humanity seems to be breeding quite nicely without them." End quote. Brittany Cooper, 2017. White people own time. Thank you.
So just to remind you, tomorrow, the reading will be at 7 p.m. and it'll be at the Hudson Public Library. Great night. I'll see you tomorrow morning.